Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here, along with Mr. William Fink, a Bible scholar and student of Greek. And we are going to do a follow-up study today based on last week's discussion of Deuteronomy chapter 2, 32, or was it 23?
23-2.
Yeah, 23-2, actually, we studied verses 1 through 7 of Deuteronomy chapter 23. Now, particularly today, we're going to do a follow-up study on Deuteronomy 23:2, which is translated in your King James as "a bastard shall not enter in the congregation of the Lord." And of course, that word "bastard" is translated from the Hebrew "mamzer," and even in Strong's Concordance, it only gives one definition of the word "mamzer," and that is "mongrel." So the proper translation of that verse is, "No mongrel shall enter the congregation of Yahweh, even unto the tenth generation." And maybe we can discuss that tenth generation business, because as we discussed last weekend, Bill, the it doesn't make any sense to talk about generations of bastards.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, people born out of wedlock. So in other words, if people are born out of wedlock for 10 generations, then they're finally acceptable. It just doesn't make any sense. There's no logic to that. But it does make sense if you talk about mamzers. And it says even 10 generations of descendants of this mamzer offspring, even they are not acceptable. Isn't that what it's saying?
Well, it's saying that literally, but metaphorically, it means that the offspring of mamzers or half-breeds are never acceptable forever.
Right, right. And that's in, that's how I understand the Septuagint translates it in actuality as forever, and not just for in terms of generations.
And if we keep the alien out of the assembly, he'll continue to maintain his own features. He won't be able to infiltrate.
That's right, that's right. And that's how the Jews have been able to infiltrate true Israel much more easily, lately, in the last couple of generations, because basically Jewish men go for white women. They marry white women for obvious reasons, and also to infiltrate our ranks. And they always insist on bringing their children up Jewish, because I've been in situations in my business doing home remodeling where I run into this situation countless times, where a Jewish man will marry a white or Catholic, usually Catholic. They prefer Catholic women for some reason. maybe there's just more of them in this town. Because I'm in Chicago, and I see that combination so often. And typically, the Jew in the family. Hello, Alan, father, from New England. Oh, North England. Sorry, not New England. Big difference. And so what we've got is a preference by Jewish men for white women. Okay. And it's consequently, they keep on breeding mamzers that are, by their own definition, the mother has to be Jewish for the offspring to be considered Jewish. But by Yahweh's definition, they're mamzers, right? Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. A mamzer is somebody of mixed race, and the Jews hate that. The Jews are definitely of mixed race. They're Canaanites and Edomites and Kenites and Girgashites and Hivites and all those other alien races in Genesis chapter 15, all mixed together.
That's right. That's right. That's all. They're all mixed up, and that's why they have such a high rate of genetic diseases, starting with Tay-Sachs, which is the most dangerous one, which actually kills their babies before they even get into the stage of being a toddler. That disease is just one of many that Jews get, and it's because their genetic programming is all messed up. It's like if you try to run a program and then you add a second program and mix those two programs together, neither one of them is going to work right. Okay? The programs were written to run separately. They weren't written to run together. And then when you run them together, you get, for example, you get a hunchback. You get the crooked face, the crooked nose. You get the slanty eyes and all these crooked features that you get from mongrelizing, okay? And I forget, there's a verse in Isaiah that says, the show of their countenance doth witness against them. And that's talking about, well, you can see a mongrel in the face very easily, You know, very easily distinguish a mongrel child. Doesn't look anything like the race of either, you know, either parent, you know, when you're talking about two different races being the parents. Also, isn't it the case that I didn't have a chance to look this up because I just got home from work, but isn't it the case that the word bastard used to mean mongrel in English, you know, in old-time English? It sort of has lost that meaning, just like the word fair used to mean white, you know, meaning pale skin, okay? And that definition is actually still contained in my foot-thick dictionary. But I'll bet most dictionaries have deleted that definition of fair, okay? What's your perspective on this, Bill?
Well, there's a prophecy, I think it's in Zechariah, and it's the only other time that the word bastard appears in the Old Testament.
Okay.
And it's against the Philistines, and it says, a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod.
Okay.
And that makes no sense at all that somebody not born in wedlock would dwell in Ashdod.
Right.
That's not what it's talking about.
Let's send them all to Ashdod. Ashdod's got to be pretty populated by now.
Absolutely. It's in Zechariah 9:6, and the bastard shall dwell in Ashdod,
okay.
And I will cut off the pride of the Philistines.
Uh-huh.
And if the bastard were defined by marriage before a priest, well, there were probably a lot of bastards dwelling in Ashdod.
Right. Yeah, because we didn't have that kind of marriage in those days that we do today.
Right.
Yes.
Evidently, Yahweh in Zechariah 9:6 is talking about the Philistines being overrun by another race or by other races and mixed. And that's actually precisely what happened, because we have a mixed race there today and have had for thousands of years.
Right. Alan Fadla in England, he's got a mixed-up family, too. Wife is semi-lapsed Catholic and brother is an ex-priest. I feel for you, Alan.
I haven't had the chance to type anything to respond to him yet, but I really feel bad for the guy already.
Yeah, right. But it's better to be ex-Catholic than Catholic, and ex-priest than priest. So.
Yeah,
good going, guys. Very good. Okay, so here, let's go into Genesis chapter 38. Where the story of Judah and Tamar occurs. And the reason why we're going into this is because the relationship between Judah and Tamar, and especially their offspring, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the offspring, namely Zerah and Perez, were acceptable to Yahweh. In other words, the very first generation offspring of Judah and Tamar were acceptable to Yahweh and part of the congregation. And indeed, Perez is counted in the genealogy of Jesus Christ without any doubt. Okay. So we're not talking, and since they were never married, we're not talking about out of wedlock birth. Okay. So let's go into chapter 38. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Okay, so here, first of all, the first clue is that he went down from his brethren or away from his brethren. Isn't that how we should be reading this? Down from his brethren is kind of an awkward phrase
right
here.
This is an awkward phrase. This is a pivotal clause, though, because Judah was a young man and he departed from his brethren for one reason or another.
Right.
In other words, he's alone in a strange place.
Right.
He's probably not alone. He probably has servants with him.
Right.
You know, when Abraham traveled, it appears that he's alone in Scripture, but he's sometimes with a contingent of 300 men.
Yes, exactly. And so he turned into, again, this is a very obscure language. He met up with or had a date with.
Well, turned into, he went to the house of
right.
The encampment of.
Right.
A certain Adullah. It may have been a tavern.
Right.
An inn in the
or a Jewish sense, or a
inn.
Jewish deli.
Yeah.
Okay.
Went for a ham sandwich.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And so we're talking about Judah meeting up with this Adullamite. Now this Adullamite, okay, well, it's the question's answered in verse 2. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. And he took her, and went into her, which means he had sex with her. Now, let me just quickly go back to the middle of this verse. A certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. That's not the woman we're talking about, is it? Or are we talking about the father of this woman?
Well, Shua is the Canaanite's name.
Yeah.
The daughter is called Beth Shua, which means daughter of Shua.
Okay. So the woman we're talking about is named Beth Shua, okay? And her father is named Shua. And they are therefore Canaanites. They are not Judahites or Israelites. They are Canaanites. And so here Judah sinned grievously by doing exactly the same thing that Esau did. And the reason why Esau despised his birthright was because he refused to take a Hebrew wife. He chose his wives out of the nation of Canaan. Isn't that correct, Bill?
That's correct. He took Hittite wives and Ishmaelite wives, and Rebekah expressed displeasure with that, which was specifically enunciated in Scripture. It's in there. Rebekah says, "My heart is troubled for the daughters of Heth."
Right.
And she instructs Isaac not to let Jacob marry a daughter of Heth.
Right. And then both Jacob and Rebekah admonish Jacob not to do the same thing that Esau did. Otherwise, he would also risk losing the birthright.
Right. Esau despised his birthright when he married foreign women.
That's right.
The bowl of porridge was only a ceremony commemorating it.
Right, yeah, that was the official sale.
Yeah.
That's right. You see, nothing happens with Jews without a sale. The sale, in this case, was a pot of porridge, okay? Verse 3, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. Okay, so Judah and Bathsheba have a son named Ur. Now, of course, this is a total violation. Okay, question. We're reading from Genesis chapter 38. Okay, and I'm on verse 4 right now. And she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bore a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chazib when she bore him. So here, Judah bore three sons from Bathsheba, who was a Canaanitess. She was not a Hebrew or an Israelite, certainly not an Israelite, as would have to be one of the daughters of Jacob from any of the other tribes. And so let me ask you a quick question here. What do you think was going on in Judah's mind here that he would even conceive of this?
Well, you know, we have a very, very abridged version of Scripture here, abridged version of the story in Scripture.
Yes.
This is several years.
Yes.
Between Shua's conception of Ur and then Onan and then Shelah. This didn't all happen in an evening.
Right.
This probably took a couple of years. And if we go to the Testament of Judah, now I can't prove the veracity of this story.
Okay.
But it's one reflection of early Hebrew tradition as to what happened here, and it's the only other insight we have.
Okay.
And in the Testament of Judah, in the version found in the Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden, chapter 1, verses 51 to 53, and chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, I would like to read some of that.
Surely.
It says, I was 20 years old. This is Judah, supposedly Judah.
Okay.
Speaking this.
Okay.
I was 20 years old when this war befell, and the Canaanites feared me and my brethren.
Mm-hmm.
And I had much cattle, and I was the chief herdsman, and I had for chief herdsman Hiram the Adullamite. And when I went to him, I saw Parsaba, king of Adullam, and he spoke unto us, and he made a feast. And when I was heated, meaning like he was drunk and sexually excited. He's a young man.
Right.
At a feast, at a party. You know what goes on at parties with
Sure. Saints,
women and things like that.
Exactly. Yes.
He gave me his
Hard
daughter
playing.
Bathsheba to wife.
Right.
And when I was heated, he gave me his daughter Bathsheba to wife. Bathsheba meaning just daughter of Shua.
Yes.
And I knew that the race of the Canaanite was wicked, but the impulse of youth blinded my mind.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw her pouring out wine, owing to the intoxication of the wine, I was deceived and took her, although my father had not counseled it.
Right.
In other words, he took her for a wife without the counsel of his father.
Right.
He was a young man, but he was of age.
Yeah.
And in a drunken state of agitation.
Right.
I've been there.
Yeah.
I can't fault the guy.
He went to a state university.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, right. It happens all over over society today, and it has.
And throughout history.
Right.
But certainly Judah should have known better.
Well, he evidently did the, I hate to say it, but he evidently did the gentlemanly thing.
I see.
And kept this woman.
Right.
Or maybe the father compelled him to keep this woman.
Right,
it's the law.
Okay.
And you'd have one law for yourself and for the stranger. And even though it's an Edomite and they're cursed, or a Canaanite and they're cursed.
Right. And he even says so. Yeah. So isn't it true that whenever we have dealings with Jews, things go south for us? Things tend to go bad whenever we have that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that whenever we try to bless the curse of Yahweh, we get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a cause and effect. There's
no
way around it. It's like the laws of physics.
Yeah. The Bible repeatedly tells us that to make no covenants with these Canaanites, and every time we do, they cheat us or kill us or what have you. And we always wind up with the short end of the stick whenever we deal with Jews, okay? Because they're connivers, and they don't obey the law of Yahweh, even though they pretend to, okay? All right, my thought on this, and I have absolutely nothing to back this up, is possibly Judah was upset with the fact that Joseph received the birthright and was kind of full of spite. And
at this point in his life, Joseph is gone.
Okay, right. Right, exactly. That occurred, but he still could have been full of spite for that having happened, okay? But Judah did retain the scepter. And I don't know, it kind of sounds like Judah had an Esau episode.
Well, right, but in this point in his life, I believe that Judah the birthright still belongs to Judah because they haven't gone to Egypt yet, and Joseph isn't discovered. They have Joseph for dead.
Okay, all right. So then it's just stupidity on his part, as he's saying, but probably more going on than just that. Probably more than just stupidity.
Absolutely, it's the pride of youth, and,
yes.
And I spent my entire youth with much the same pride.
Yeah, rebelliousness. Yes. Okay.
And
all right.
Was humbled in my older
yeah,
years.
Yeah. We either get humbled or we get killed. One or the other. right. Okay, so he bore three sons out of Beth Shua, and they were named Onan, and Shelah. Okay, so let's look at verse 6. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. Now, who do you think Tamar is?
Well, the Book of Jasher, you know, there's a lot of people in Palestine. It's a crossroads.
Right.
And not everybody in the land of Canaan was a Canaanite. And the scripture shows us that over and over again if people would only open their eyes to it.
Right.
There were Egyptians in Palestine in large numbers during this time.
Uh-huh.
I can cite specific instances that show this in James Pritchard's ancient Near Eastern text relating to the Old Testament, which is basically a book of ancient inscriptions, wherever the history of the nations surrounding the land of Israel come in touch with the people of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are thousands of inscriptions in this book. The Book of Jasher says that Tamar was an Elamite.
Okay.
And that she was of the house of Shem.
Right.
And a daughter of the sons of Elam, that would make her akin to the Persians. And they were Shemites, and they were white, and they were Aryans, and they were every bit kinsmen to the Israelites.
Right.
They just weren't the chosen line.
Right. Right.
That's what Jasher says. So whether that's true or not,
okay.
I mean, because I know that parts of the Book of Jasher cannot be trusted,
right.
And I believe that parts of the Book of Jasher can be trusted.
Yeah.
I think that the Book of Jasher probably... suffered was originally a a good book at its core and suffered many emendations and interpolations,
right.
And that could be a topic for a whole other night.
Right.
But
right.
The Jasher says that Tamar was an Elamite,
okay.
Which reflects Persian. It reflects at least an early Israelite tradition that she was a white woman and not a Canaanite.
Right, right. Well, and even Jacob himself, he went to Laban to get his wives. And wasn't Laban also of Elam, or no?
That's difficult. Laban can be related to Arphaxad down through the same line that Abraham came from.
Okay.
So the cousin.
Right, right.
And I have that not from the Bible, but from certain apocryphal literature.
Right, right.
But that's besides the point. Even if we take the Bible at face value without the apocryphal literature, Laban is called Laban the Syrian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word Syrian, everywhere it appears in the Old Testament, is from the Hebrew word Aram.
Right.
And Aram was the uncle of Eber, the Hebrew.
Right, right.
And the Syrians were white.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, they're mentioned very often in the earliest Greek literature, the
mm-hmm.
Syrians.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah. So getting back to verse 1, we're talking brethren, okay?
Definitely.
Yeah. So they're brethren, they're extended family. They're a family of the 10 nations that were discussed in, Genesis chapter 10. I forget exactly where.
The Elamites, the Aramaeans, there's a lot of people in the land of Palestine at this time that are definitely white, Adamic, Genesis 10
right.
people.
Right. And all of these major nations that started and began in Mesopotamia, they're all of the Noahite line, and therefore they're all brethren. Okay? That's how I understand it. I think that's how everybody else should understand it, correct?
Absolutely.
Yes.
And,
okay.
And the Israelites, the early Israelites, couldn't marry Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
There was one woman.
That's right.
One female was Dinah.
They had to pick their wives from some other tribe. Right.
Right. And the Bible tells us, you know, that it was important to Isaac and Rebekah that they picked their wives from the correct tribe.
That's right. That's right.
And it was important that Abraham yeah. sent a Laban the Syrian for a wife for Isaac.
Yes. Yes.
But for Rebekah herself came from the same house that Sarah had come
right.
from.
Right, yeah. So those 10 nations that descended from Noah all are white Adamic people and no one else, okay? And it certainly is not true, as many people believe, that Ham was black, Shem was white, and Japheth was Chinese, okay?
Well, that's absolutely crazy, because
yes.
if I slept with my wife and a white child came out, I'd be happy, and the second time I slept with her, and a yellow child came out.
Yes.
I'm not sleeping with her the first time.
Right, exactly. And through what, 2,000 years of European history, until recently when race mixing became common, there was no such thing ever as a black child born from two white people in all of Europe's history. You know.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Or different races being born from the same couple.
That's right. It's ridiculous.
I have a paper that I wrote. It's on my website. It's on christogenia.org. It's called The Race of Genesis 10, and in it I discuss much of the evidence that all of those early people listed in Genesis 10 were actual nations
right.
that were identified, and they were all white nations.
Yeah, all from the sons descended from Noah, no doubt about
right.
it, and his three sons. Okay. All right, so I think it's fairly well established that Tamar was a white woman, just as Judah was a white man. Okay, verse 7. And Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh slew him. So we have to assume here that did not impregnate Tamar, okay, because the Bible would have said so. It goes into a little more detail with Onan, and Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her. And as we discussed last time, when a man in the Old Testament days, when a man had sex with a woman, they were considered married from that point on. And so Judah was instructing Onan to have sex with Tamar, and then he says, raise up seed to your brother. Okay, all of this is contrary to the law of Moses, okay? And verse 9, and Onan knew that the seed should not be his. What do you think it says here?
The levirate rule of marriage is to, when a when a man dies without issue, his brother is to take that wife and raise up seed to her.
Okay.
And Onan knew that the seed would not be his. That means that the son would be attributed to his brother.
Exactly. To
and Onan would miss the inheritance because that son would get it.
Yes, yes. And he didn't want it.
Place.
Yeah. And, of course, since Onan was actually a non-Hebrew, he probably, this tradition was probably from Judah. And the Canaanites, I don't believe, had this kind of tradition. And so he wanted nothing to do with it, correct?
Right. The tradition, well, the tradition comes out in Genesis. It's specifically mentioned in the law in Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 9.
Okay.
If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to him to wife.
Yes.
To perform the duty of the husband's brother unto her.
Yeah.
Which indicates also that this tradition had been around for a long time.
Right.
And it's also in the Testament of Zebulun.
Okay.
It's explained in that, in the Lost Books of the Bible, at great length.
All right. Okay.
So we see that if a man dies without issue, his brother is to take his wife and impregnate her.
Right.
And there's more to that story that I'd like to discuss, but not until we get to Tamar's liaison with Judah.
Right. Right. Okay.
Maybe a few verses away here.
But the key thing to notice here is that the offspring of the second husband are to be counted for the first husband, and thereby that offspring would bypass the second husband in an inheritance, correct?
Right.
Right.
Onan would have his own wife.
Yes.
All right, but he would also impregnate Tamar in honor of his brother who died without issue.
Right, right.
And the son or daughter or whatever be the case that issues from that union would be Ur's son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that child would get the inheritance
that
would have gotten, which in Hebrew tradition, I mean, I can't prove that it's this early, but it is later in the Levitical law, would be the double portion.
Right. Oh, okay.
Or in other words, the portion that Joseph got later.
Right, right.
In other words, would get the double portion. But if has no children, that double portion falls to Onan.
That's right. Right. And so Onan would want that.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay.
So he would spill his seed on the ground, which is what he did. He would not impregnate Tamar.
Okay, so I'll continue with verse 9. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother, which is exactly what you just explained. Okay, so verse 10. And the thing which he did displeased Yahweh, that wherefore he slew him also. Okay, well, it had to displease Yahweh that two Canaanite men were trying to impregnate Tamar.
This is a demonstration that Yahweh uses his own laws against the Jews.
Right.
Against the Edomites, against the children of Cain, against the enemy.
Yes.
There's a law later on in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, thou shalt not spill thy seed on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't, a lot of people think that, I don't even want to get into anything vulgar, but a lot of people think that bans certain other acts that we love to do when we're children.
Right.
But it really means that you're not supposed to pull out when you're going to copulate in your wife.
Right, right.
Pulling out is not a viable method of birth control.
Right, right. Okay, I see. All right, but that's what Onan did in this case. Because it clearly says he went into his brother's wife, or at least he attempted to have sex with her, whether he did so. So obviously, she was not impregnated by this encounter, otherwise.
Right, and technically, by the law, she's not, her marriage neither has not yet been consummated.
Right.
Technically, she's still a virgin because nobody's copulated into her yet.
Yes, right. That's right. Okay, very good. This is the kind of thing that would make a tremendous soap opera for daytime television.
Yeah, absolutely.
We should start a series called The Bible, because the Bible is full of sex and gore, folks, like it or not. Verse 11, then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house till Shelah my son be grown, for he said, lest perhaps he die also as his brethren did. Do you think Judah would have got the message by now?
Right.
And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So she had to leave and dwell in her father's house to wait for Shelah to grow up. To what age? 21?
Well, 20 is the customary age. That's the age when a man could go to war.
Okay.
And that's the age when a man is of age.
Okay.
For a woman, it was 16, I believe.
Okay.
In Hebrew and amongst the Greeks, and 20 for a man.
Right, right. But Tamar could have been considerably older than Shelah at this point, I would think.
Yeah, we don't really have an indication of how old she is, but it can be shown that she's probably not very old. It's circumstantial.
Right, right. Okay, but certainly... the age requirements or age traditions in those days were probably nothing like they are today, where it seems like men prefer younger women, but that isn't always true, okay? So let's continue here. So he sent Tamar away because Shelah was not old enough yet, okay? Verse 12. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, okay? So Bathshua dies, and was comforted, and went up to his sheep shearers. I think it should say, and Judah was comforted, right? This is an awkward translation here. And went up to his sheep shearers to Timnath, he and his friend Hira, and Hira the Adullamite. Okay, now who's this Hira the Adullamite? Is he one of our people, or is he a Canaanite?
You know, I haven't looked up Hiram the Adullamite, but
okay.
I would like to. I'm absolutely not positive.
Yeah, but it sounds like this whole story is set in Judah went to Canaanite territory, okay, and he hired according to what book was the Testament of Judah that you read from another book?
Yes, the Testament of Judah from the Lost Books of the Bible.
Okay, and this Yeshua was tending Judah's flocks. That's what that story tells us?
Yes.
Okay. So either...
Hira the Adullamite. The Adullamite was tending Judah's flocks.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're not sure exactly who Hira the Adullamite is. Okay. Verse 13. And it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear his sheep. So Tamar gets wind of the story that Judah is going to come by this way, verse 14, and she put her widow's garments off from her and covered her with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath, for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as a wife. And that's not telling us how Tamar feels about all of this stuff, whether she wants to be the wife of these Canaanite men or not, okay? But women didn't have much to say about this in those days, so it seems like she took these things fairly passively here. At least that's the implication. But this expression here, by the way, isn't it true that the non-Israelite traditions, certainly stemming from Babylon and incorporated by the Canaanites and Edomites, was that in Babylon and various other places in the pagan world, women had to prostitute themselves by sitting near a highway, and they had to sell themselves to the first man that offered them money. Isn't that true?
Yeah, there was no discrimination when it came to when you were playing the act of a prostitute.
Right, right, and. It was expected of women to prostitute themselves in Babylonian tradition. And, of course, the Hebrew tradition was the exact opposite of that. Okay.
In the Babylonian nation, where is it? It's in Herodotus.
Okay.
And it's evident in the Bible, but I really don't want to...
Mm-hmm.
It might be Daniel, or it might be Ezra or Nehemiah. It's been a long time. It's in my Broken Cisterns pamphlet.
Okay.
And I wrote that like 6 or 7 years ago, and I
right.
honestly don't remember it.
Right. Yeah, but it's important for people to know that the Canaanite tradition included race mixing without question, but the Hebrew tradition was the exact opposite. Okay.
In my Broken Cisterns pamphlet, it's explained that once in her lifetime,
yeah,
every woman in Babylonia,
yeah,
was expected to go down to this certain temple and sit there until somebody bought her.
Yes.
And had sex with that man.
Right.
The price of the sex would go to the temple.
Right.
And
right,
every woman in Babylonia was expected to do that once in her life.
Right, right. You know what? You know what? That kind of religion is back with us today, isn't it? Because you look at Hollywood and all the porn industry, every woman is expected to prostitute herself.
Yeah, it all revolves, yeah, around sex.
It's the fornications of Mystery Babylon are back with us today, aren't they?
Yes, and the first condition for a woman, you know, to get married anymore is how much money you have.
Yeah,
all
right. Exactly. Okay, so verse 14 tells us that she took off her widow's garments and dressed herself and put a veil on so that Judah did not recognize her. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. Verse 16, and he turned to her by the way and said, go to, I pray you, let me come in to you. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law, and she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? So here is, in modern terminology, a prostitute and her John, okay? A prostitute and her John setting the price for the engagement, right?
Basically, that's what it is. And this shows Judah's incontinence also.
Uh-huh.
And if he was incontinent at this stage in his life, when he was much older,
yes,
you can imagine how he ended up hooked up with the Canaanite.
Right, right.
20 or 30 years before, or however long.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's something definitely going wrong in Judah's mind, but of course that's true of most of the kings of the Israelites and the Judahites throughout the Old Testament history, okay?
They took right after him.
Yes, and Ephraim too, yeah. The whole northern house of Israel was thrown into exile because of their failure to obey Yahweh's laws in these matters, okay? Verse 17, and he said, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? Okay, so she's expecting him to send a kid from the flock, which is a goat, a young goat, from his herd, okay, in verse 18. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your signet and your bracelets and your staff that is in your hand. So she required three personal objects from Judah's person. Now, what is a signet?
These aren't mere personal objects. These are the displays of Judah's wealth and station in life.
Okay.
His signet is the seal that he uses to sign contracts with.
Right. He gave this to a prostitute?
Yeah.
What's the matter with this guy?
This is crazy.
Yeah. But I guess
This would be like you giving a prostitute your wallet.
That's right.
With your blank checks and your credit cards in it.
Right. Here, have it all. Take it all.
Yes. Absolutely. That's what this represents.
Yes. Yes. So your signet, your bracelets, and your staff. Now, the staff is more than just a shepherd's staff, right?
Well, it may be just a shepherd's staff at this point. A lot of people say that it's the symbol of royalty.
Okay, that would be the scepter.
But Judah hasn't obtained any royalty yet.
Right.
His brethren haven't. They're obviously a large, influential family,
mm-hmm,
but they haven't obtained royalty or nationhood yet.
Right, right.
That doesn't happen until
Saul and David.
So Jacob foretells it in Genesis chapter 48 or 49.
Right.
Or,
yeah. So Judah himself was never actually a king, but his descendants were to become kings.
Right, yeah. But Judah was a
scepter-bearer.
An influential, powerful man, being the oldest son in a large and wealthy family.
Right.
And that is a station of rank.
Exactly. Okay. All right, so then it says he gave it to her. He gave her all these things and came into her, and she conceived by him. Okay, so She now is pregnant as a result of this liaison by the road. Okay, verse 19. And she arose and went away and laid by her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. So she planned, it looks like she planned this whole thing.
Absolutely. Yes. And she did it. A lot of people say, oh, Tamar was a whore, Tamar was this, Tamar was that, and they're just blasphemers.
Right.
If Tamar was a whore, she would have went and got pregnant from anybody.
Right.
It didn't matter if she really wanted a baby,
mm-hmm.
who she got pregnant by.
Right.
She wanted the law upheld that she was entitled to the seed or offspring from this family.
Okay.
Now, that compelled her to do what she did, and only that.
Yes.
Because she was probably an attractive woman, and back then it didn't really matter. You go to a shepherd in the desert if you need it.
Right,
I mean, it's a lot better than the sheep.
Well, let me suggest this. Don't you think that she maybe was expecting, because this means that she is married to Judah, okay?
And, oh, yes.
And as his wife, she would become the wife of royalty.
Well,
she would expect
that,
at least.
She could not have known that. She couldn't. I mean, she must have known that Judah was an influential man and the oldest son of a large family, but she couldn't have known that he was going to be, that his descendants were going
to be. But I mean, and certainly in terms.
Unless she was a prophetess, but she's not called a prophetess.
Right. But I just mean in terms of the man Judah that she knew, vis-a-vis Onan and Shelah and all these other men, that he was the most powerful man that she had become familiar with, apparently.
Well,
you know,
she must have known that he was a much better choice to have a child by than the rug salesman down the road.
Right. That's what I'm getting to.
To a woman in these times, there's no Social Security.
No.
And
no.
You can't be a prostitute. Even if you choose a life of prostitution, that won't get you much past 30 or 40.
Yes.
Children are very, very important to women in the ancient world.
Right.
Because they expected, especially sons, because they expected these children to be able to look after the woman in her old age.
Exactly.
And nobody, it's hard to be 70 and alone.
Yes.
And women felt that they were, it was very important for them to raise sons so that they would be taken care of later in life.
Right.
And that's the way the ancient world was before Social Security and Uncle Sam and nursing homes.
And by the way, Social Security will be no more.
Yeah.
It's funny. 600,000 people lost their jobs in January alone in America, folks. You can expect this entire thing to come crashing down totally. It's not going to recover. But in any case, there's another point I want to bring up here, and that it's the story of Lot and his two daughters. The fact is that our women had an intense race consciousness in those days. They wanted to bring forth more Israelite Hebrew children. And in the case of Lot, his own two daughters got him drunk in order that they would be impregnated by him. And that was Ammon and Moab were the result, correct?
Right. And Lot wasn't faulted for that because he was later on, he was still called righteous.
That's right.
And we can all become victims of one thing or another.
But it just proves that to the extent to which his daughters wanted to conceive seed to their race.
Yeah, they thought the world was over.
Yeah,
it was also a disgrace at that time to die for a man to die without sons.
Ah, okay.
And Lot's daughters obviously knew that Lot had no sons.
Right. And in spite of it, Ammon and Moab became cursed tribes anyway, because they were born of incest, okay, which was also the same for Canaan. Canaan was born of incest. That's why Canaan was cursed and not Ham.
Right, because a man who uncovers his father's skirt has laid with his father's wife.
Yes, that's right.
And we have to read that law in Leviticus and understand the story of Ham and Canaan, and why Canaan was cursed, and not Mitzrayim or Cush or Ham's other children.
Yes. So everybody listening, you better start putting those thoughts out of your mind of messing around with other women. Okay, verse 19. And she arose and went away and laid by her veil by her and put on the garments of her widow. So she resumed her true identity, verse 20. And Judah sent the kid by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. So in other words, the kid that he promised her in exchange for the pledge, for these items that he left with her. Okay, verse 21. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot that was openly by the wayside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. And he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. And also the men of the place said that there was no harlot in this place. So Judah has to be going nuts here. Now, who's this woman that has my staff, has my signet? And what was the other item? She's got all of these possessions of mine. I have no idea who she is, and nobody can find her. This is serious embarrassment time, isn't it, for Judah?
Absolutely, because of the significance of the staff and the signet. And
right. That was pretty stupid to leave those things with what he understood to be a stranger.
Right. These things are symbols of Judah's wealth and stature and position. It's his ability to make contracts is in his signet. I mean, she could be out making contracts for him.
That's right.
And just come back to haunt them.
Right.
And actually to ruin them financially.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this is, it's pretty serious.
Yes, like, this is serious stuff.
Up here.
Yeah. It's like if we bring it up to date, like you said, the guy gives her his checkbook.
Right.
$1,000 in cash.
The whole thing.
Right. And boy, he's in big trouble if he can't find this woman. Okay. So, verse 23. And Judah said, let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Again, this is, what is it? Let her take it to her. What is this? This is awkward. What's really going on here?
Which verse?
Verse 23.
Verse 23. And Judah said, let her take it to her,
yes,
lest we be shamed. I can't answer for that.
That's really awkward.
I read it.
That's really awkward sentence construction here. So, maybe her is a mistranslation. Let him take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid, and you have not found her. Verse 24, and it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, no, he's wringing his hands for 3 months. Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth, and let her be burned. Oh, man. It's this guy, Judah.
That's the law. The law existed before it was given to the
right,
the children of Israel. It wasn't written. It wasn't recorded. But the law existed in the customs and ethics of the people handed down from the time of Noah
right,
and Adam.
Yeah.
The Septuagint 38:23 says, and Judah said, let her have them, but let us not be ridiculed.
Yes.
I sent this kid, but thou hast not found. In other words, he's saying he kept his end of the bargain up, and he's saying, to heck with my personal possession.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's definitely not evident in verse 23 in the King James Version. Okay. Very good. All right, verse 25. When she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child? So she's showing the items that Judah left with her, and she is saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child? And she said, discern, I pray you, whose are these? The signet and the bracelets and the staff.
Right. She had that as proof that she was getting what she was due.
Yes.
And Judah, in the next verse, he immediately acknowledges that.
Mm-hmm. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son, and he knew her again no more. So Judah and Tamar had this one encounter. It amazes me that Judah didn't keep her as his wife. This amazes me. But again, as we were saying, there must have been something going on in Judah's head. Maybe he had just rebelled. But in any case, via Tamar, he does now have offspring which are acceptable to Yahweh, as we will find out, folks. Verse 27, and it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it also came to pass, verse 28, when she travailed, that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. So the one that put his hand out, the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it around his wrist. Okay, so now the Irish have this tradition called the scarlet thread, son of the scarlet thread. I forget exactly the terminology they use, but isn't this the case that this is the Zerah bloodline?
Yes, it's the bloodline of Zerah Judah.
Okay.
It's the red hand and the scarlet hand.
Yes.
And it's representative of this very thing.
Scarlet hand.
Handed down through their own family mythology or family tradition.
Right.
It indicates that this is where they came from.
Yes. Okay. Now, this is all taking place before the Egyptian captivity. And so what we have going on here, because, and I know that while the Israelites were captive in Egypt, Zerah and Perez had to be growing up, and I'm sure there was probably bad blood with between them, because this issue of who is the first son, who is the oldest son, had to be an issue between these two brothers thenceforth. You know, from this episode that's being described here in verses 28 through 30, and isn't it the case that the Zerah-Judah bloodline began forming nations, founding nations around the Mediterranean era before the Exodus. Isn't that the case?
Yes, that is the case. Before the Exodus, Zerahites departed from the main body of the Israelites.
Yes.
And they founded Troy.
Okay.
Now, in the subsequent centuries, people called the Phoenicians, who were really the northern tribes of Israel.
Yes.
They were the tribes of Asher and Gad and Zebulun and Naphtali and some Danites.
Yes.
Were called the Phoenicians. They had settlements. They left Israel after the Exodus.
Uh-huh.
And they had settlements in what is known as Caria, which the chief city is Miletus.
Okay.
And Thessaly, which is part of what we know now as Greece.
Yes, okay.
And Crete, and Colchia, which is actually where Paul of Tarsus was raised.
Okay.
And these Phoenician settlements, they took, and this is attested to by Strabo, they took their kings from Trojan princes.
Okay.
They knew that the Trojans were to rule over them.
Right, because they knew that they were Zerahites of Judah.
They had to. They had to know that the people of Troy were Zerahites, were the royal race.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
Being Trojan was synonymous all down through the Roman period. The Roman Caesars,
yes,
claimed their right to rule the earth through their Trojan blood, and French kings, Frankish kings, and Germanic kings.
Yes.
Tried to associate themselves with Trojan bloodlines,
yes,
to claim their right to rule. I have evidence in Procopius, the historian, that Justinian, the famous emperor, was a Trojan by race.
Okay.
He was an Illyrian. He was of the tribe of the Dardans.
Right.
Who were
right.
Of the dispersed of the Trojans from after the Trojan War.
Right.
And the Zerahite bloodline as not the Perez bloodline is the bloodline of David and Yahshua Christ that
right.
ruled over us in Palestine,
exactly.
But the Zerahite bloodline supplied kings to the white nations of the Mediterranean, the Phoenician Israelite
right.
nations for many, many
yeah.
years.
And also the British kings and queens, right? Because
right.
Brutus.
And the Roman Caesars.
Yeah.
The Roman Caesars, Julius Caesar, claimed his descent right from Aeneas, the Trojan prince.
Right, right. So from Aeneas, one of his offspring was Brutus. Correct? And Brutus?
Yeah, there's a tradition that Brutus after two or three generations in Alba Longa, which is the colony in Italy that eventually became known to us as Rome, that Brutus departed from there and went and founded a city which eventually became known to us as London.
Right.
Now,
right.
In
and it was originally called New Troy, Caer Troy, which proves that they came from Troy, okay, saw themselves as Troyans or Trojans.
Well, we believe that because the Romans knew of a tribe of what they considered to be Britons.
Right.
In that area known as the Trinovantes, which very much seems to be New Trojans or Troy, New Troy.
Right.
The people of New Troy.
Yes, yes. Okay. So New Troy eventually became known as London. And isn't it true that the Caesars of Rome acknowledged the British kings and queens as Trojans? Isn't that true? Down through the ages? And isn't that why they intermarried so much? Helen of Troy was a Brit. And she married, what, Caractacus? I forget what...
I wouldn't say that Helen of Troy is... No, I think you have a couple of things confused,
okay,
to be honest with you.
All right. I'm sorry. I mean Helen of Wales. Sorry. Helen of Wales is what I'm trying to say. So their offspring was Constantine. So,
his father was the old King Cole of legend. His name, I think, was Colowin,
yes,
or something very similar to that. And she was a British princess, which would have put her from the race of the Trojans. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So all of these kings and queens of Europe, and this is a point I want to stress so strongly, are descendants of Zerah Judah.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
They're all Zerah Judah is very a very prominent family in history, but it's hidden from most people that this is actually
right.
Zerah Judah.
And
I have a paper on my website that makes the connection with Zerah and the Trojans and the Romans.
Okay.
And it's called Classical Records in Trojan Roman Judah.
Okay. Outstanding. Because this fulfills the prophecy. One of the prophecies that deals with the fact that our people, true Israel, would have kings and queens come from the loins of Judah. Okay? That the sun would not, you know, as long as there's a sun and stars in the sky, there would be a literal king descended from Judah sitting on a throne somewhere on this planet. Okay? And so these Zerah Judahite kings and queens are half the fulfillment of that promise, which the Jews do not fulfill in any way, shape, or form, because they're Edomites and Canaanites, and there's no kings and queens that have come from the Jews.
Right, they're bank presidents.
Yes, exactly. So here we find that the king line, the seed line of Judah, is established in Europe. Rome, Troy, Greece, Britain, probably Germany as well. Okay, certainly Gaul in France, through Judah, through Zerah, correct? Isn't this true history?
Well, there was a reuniting of the kings of the descendants of Pharez with the descendants of Zerah.
Okay.
But yes, much more of the royalty of Europe,
yes,
and of the early Mediterranean Europe has come through us through Zerah.
Okay, all right, let's explore. Let's go to verse 29, and we'll get into that in more detail. And it came to pass, now remember the verse 28 was a scarlet thread, and the scarlet thread was Zerah. And Zerah went as far west as Ireland, folks. Verse 29, and it came to pass as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, that's the midwife said, how have you broken forth? This breach be upon you. Therefore his name was called Pharez. Okay, so... the midwife was anticipating Zerah to come out first, but Pharez came out first. And so what is this expression, this breach be upon you? What is it?
Pharez is it's actually, I hate to say it, but I have to, it's the same Hebrew word that gives us the name Perez.
Yes.
Which we find in Spain, which is actually a Jewish Spanish name.
Right.
And we see in one of the the prime ministers of the Israeli state.
Exactly.
Shimon Peres, it's the same name.
Right. Well, they assume Hebrew names to keep us fooled, you know. So.
Yeah, well, of course.
Yes.
But Peres means to break, to part, to split.
Yes.
And that's why he was. That's why that's the connection with the word breach here.
Right. So he broke out of his mother's womb first before Zerah. Therefore, he is the older child. Correct.
Yes, Perez is the older child,
mm-hmm.
and therefore he is the child whom gave us the royalty in Palestine, and from whom Christ came.
Yes. And so now, if we turn to Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3. We find out that Jesus Christ is descended through Perez. Isn't that the case?
Right. And even in Matthew chapter 1, Perez is mentioned because he's in the genealogy of Christ.
Right.
And Zerah is mentioned as his brother.
Right.
And that's important because Shelah is not mentioned.
Shelah, right. Mm-hmm.
And somehow this midwife or Tamar, or both of them, knew that Judah's Canaanite sons were not eligible for the inheritance or to
right.
continue with name in Israel, because it was important which one of these twins was born first.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
And if Shelah or Shelah was the accounted as the oldest son who would get the inheritance,
yes.
it wouldn't matter whether Perez or Zerah were born first.
That's right. That's right.
Neither of them nobody would care.
Alan Fadla is asking a question. Pharisee, is there a connection between Perez and Pharisee? No, I think
it's a connection in the linguistics of the name and
right.
the, of the word, but it's used in two totally different
right.
contexts.
Right, right. Yeah, Pharisee means separated ones. They separated themselves from the rest of the people. Yeah,
and so they use a form of the same word to denote that.
Right, right. But a totally different meaning from the word Perez, which whose brother Zerah. Yes.
And as a side note, our language, I can identify 1,000 English words that you would never, ever think were Hebrew words that are.
Right, right.
And that part is one of them.
Uh-huh.
And separate.
Right.
Separate.
Separate, exactly.
Perez, parat.
Yes.
The PH and the P in Hebrew are basically the same letter.
Right.
Just like
right.
the S and the SH are the same letter.
Right.
Just like Tamar, T-A-M-A-R, is in Matthew when he wrote it in Greek, Samar, T-H-A-M-A-R.
Okay, right.
Okay. If you go look at Matthew 1:3. Which is where it is. And uh-huh. Judas begat Perez and Zerah of Tamar.
Right.
S-C-H-T, P-H-P, S-H-S. They're all the same letter in Hebrew.
Right, right. Yeah.
And Peretz or Perez, the actual Hebrew word is Peretz, P-A-R-A-T-S, I think, strong spelled
okay.
it in English letters.
All right.
Is our word part.
Yes, exactly.
And separate. It's the core meaning of the word separate.
Right, right. So Peretz, who parted his mother's womb first before Zerah had a chance to come out, that all harkens back, this language all harkens back to this incident recorded in Genesis 38. This is our history, folks. These are our ancestors. They're not Jews. And they're not ancestors of the Jews either. The Jews did not have these people as ancestors. Shelah did. Shelah is one of the ancestors of the Jews. But neither Zerah or Perez were Jews. And the Jews do not have either of these two men as their ancestors. Correct?
And we have the Shilonites, the people called Shilonites. You see, Shelah or Shelah, however you want to pronounce it. I'm bad at pronunciation because I spent so many years as a hermit. and never heard these words pronounced. I only read them.
Right. Okay.
Is mentioned in the book of Nehemiah.
Yes.
But in the book of Nehemiah, it's Shilonite. But that's the Shilonites. That's the descendants of Shelah.
Right. Exactly.
And that's in it's in 1 Chronicles 9:5.
Yeah.
And it's in Nehemiah.
Well, and it's a fact of case. That the Shelahites resided in that territory after the House of Israel was deported around 745 B.C. and continued to reside there after the House of Judah was taken to Babylon in, 680 B.C., whatever it was, 680 B.C., something like that?
Judah, Babylon, 585 B.C.
Oh, 585 B.C. And those Shilohites still resided in that area, which is still even today called Samaria.
Yes, part of them resided in what the King James Version of the Bible calls plants and hedges.
Plants and hedges?
Yeah, they lived in plants and hedges.
Okay.
Actually, that they should not have translated those words, Netaim and Gadara.
Okay.
And they translated them, and the King James says they lived
so
in plants
and hedges.
So
those should be place names, not plant names.
Yeah. Later versions recognize that.
I see. So don't let anybody tell you, folks, that there's no mistakes in the King James Version.
Absolutely.
So what are those the place names? Oh, okay, place names can be named after plants. And so the King James translators just didn't really understand what was going on here.
Right, they translated the words literally.
They translated the words literally, when they should have been names of towns.
Yes.
Or vicinities, at the very least. Okay.
Yes, Netaim and Gadara.
Right. And those people, the Shilohites, were the half-breed descendants of Judah, and obviously, as in the case of Canaan, and as in the case of Esau, when they married into the Kenite/Canaanite people, their offspring remained Canaanite from that point on. They didn't have much infusion of Israelite blood. So all that really is taking place here is in all three cases, Shelah via Judah, and Canaan when he married into the Edomites, and Esau when he married into the Hittites. In each case, there's an infusion of Hebrew blood, but that's the end of it. From that point on, it's all Canaanite blood, except, you know, there might have been an occasional Hebrew that wandered over to the Canaanites and lived with them, but the Bible doesn't record those. So these people have very little, and the point I'm getting at is these people have very little Hebrew/Shemitic/Israelite blood in them. You would have to say it's got to be 95% to 99% Canaanite, correct?
Well, I would say that the preponderance of Canaanite is definitely there, but I wouldn't try to put a number on it.
Okay.
They are identified with Judah, but they were never really a proper part of the nation.
Right. They never were.
They always claim, and this is a great curse to the tribe of Judah. Judah's doing this.
Yes.
They were always there. They were in the Exodus. They're in the book of Numbers. They're enumerated amongst Judah's sons.
Right.
They're always there, and they're always a curse.
Yes.
And
okay.
There's no escaping them.
Now, but the point that you just made a little while ago is well taken. Even though Shelah is the older son, he's older than both Phares and Zerah, Shelah is not counted in the genealogy.
Right. They knew it. They mentioned him there, but they knew that he wasn't eligible.
Right.
Or it wouldn't have been important which son
exactly.
was born first, Phares or Zerah.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why, back in Genesis chapter 4, Cain does not have Adam listed as his father.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cain's not Adam's son.
That's right. So who is Cain the son of?
in Cain's genealogy, Adam's not mentioned.
That's right.
And that's for an important reason.
Exactly, because Adam was not his father. His father was Nahash, the whisperer, the enchanter, the deceiver, who seduced Eve, okay? And that word, seduced, is used even in the New Testament. Was it Jude or Paul? I forget who uses it. But, you know, that's probably a subject for another show. And in fact, next week, folks, we'll be doing a show on 2 Seed Line and probably maybe two or three more. But the whole point here is that ordinarily the oldest son gets the inheritance, but in this case, the oldest son, Shelah, did not, because he was a mongrel.
Yes, and that's part of the story. It's an intricate part of the story.
Yes.
It has to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
It should make even you, the most staunch universalists, wonder.
Yes.
Because there is no behavior. You know, a lot of times they say, oh, Cain was only disinherited because he killed Abel.
Right, right.
Well, they can't say that about this Shelah.
Right. He didn't kill anybody. Yeah.
Judah protected Shelah.
Yes.
By not giving him to Tamar, because that union with Tamar just killed those first two boys.
That's right. Well, he didn't seem to understand that at the time, but maybe he got older and wiser.
Right. So, there can be no excuse made here. The absolute only reason why Shelah can be discounted from the inheritance is because he's a bastard.
That's right. In the old-fashioned sense of the word, namely,
right.
Mongrel, yes.
He's the produce of a Canaanite mother.
Yes, exactly.
And,
which
and
would make
Tamar,
him,
who they all love to put up as a whore, even though she absolutely was not a whore.
That's right.
Her son got the inheritance.
Right. So here we have, now let's go back to Deuteronomy 23:2. No mongrel shall enter the congregation of Yahweh. All right? So, if Shelah, we can, without any debate, talk about Shelah being a mongrel. But he was born in wedlock. Haven't the universalists got this backwards?
Absolutely. Because they don't understand wedlock is...
Yeah.
Wedlock happens not at an altar. It happens at the point of copulation.
So Shelah is not a bastard, according to their definition, yet he doesn't get the inheritance. Don't they understand the logic of the situation here?
No, and this is a good way to set them out. If you could keep their attention long enough.
Yes.
With universalists, usually you can't get them to this point.
Right, right, because it requires thought. You have to take the dunce cap off and put your thinking cap on and realize that the bastard children got the inheritance. According to your definition of bastard, okay? And the true son, Shelah, was frozen out. Why? Because the word mamzer in Hebrew means mongrel. It doesn't mean born out of wedlock.
Right.
Okay?
Absolutely. Half-breed.
Yes.
Half-breed, so, mongrel.
Is there any other way that this can possibly be interpreted?
No, because no bad behavior, or Shelah was protected by his father.
Right.
Even though he was a bastard, his father evidently cared for him.
Yes, yeah. So even though there's a lot of bad behavior going on here.
We can't attribute any bad behavior to Shelah.
Right.
And therefore he only lost his inheritance because he was a bastard.
That's right. A mongrel. Exactly. Okay. Not a bastard in their sense, not in the universalistic sense, in the Catholic sense.
Right. Well, the Catholics, their sense just doesn't make any sense.
That's right. That's right. That's why the Bible is so confusing to people who don't understand it from the identity point of view. Okay?
Well, a lot of people say that adultery and fornication and
right,
all right, my own mother, I had a conversation with her about this at great length just a few months ago.
Okay.
Because she was born a New England Baptist, but she had a stepfather who was a Catholic that paid for her to and put her through Catholic school.
Okay.
And he was a Lithuanian Catholic, and he adopted her and put her through and gave her a Catholic education.
Right. So she's a bastard.
Right. By the church standards.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
I apologize to your mother. Sorry.
She has this Catholic education.
Yes.
And she told me one day, but adultery and fornication are the same thing.
Right, okay.
And I sat her down and I showed her three places in the New Testament where Paul of Tarsus mentions adultery and fornication in the same verse.
Right.
So they can't be the same thing.
Yeah, he wouldn't be repeating himself unnecessarily, yes.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And the Catholic Church wants to teach that adultery is sex outside of marriage.
Yes.
And that a bastard is a child born out of wedlock, but Scripture disproves that time and time again.
Yeah, well, shouldn't, you know, if you take the verb form of adultery, it is adulterate, okay? And to adulterate means to pollute, to make
right.
impure.
So okay. I have a theory that I can't prove.
Okay.
And I believe that because when we look at the Ten Commandments, that was the case,
yes.
what you just said,
yes. okay.
in Hebrew, okay?
All right.
However, in Greek, the word translated adultery, it means to mix,
yes.
but it's used in a different sense. It's used very often in secular Greek writing as just confusion of the bloodline.
Ah.
Type of mixing.
Right.
Where
right.
a woman having sex outside of her marital relationship, even with somebody of the same race,
yes.
was committing, the word is moikao, is the verb,
mixing.
Which means to adulterate,
yes.
is committing adultery.
Okay.
And
okay.
That's the context that it's used in secular Greek writings and in the New Testament.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the New Testament, the apostles chose another word to denote race mixing.
Okay.
And that was what is porneis, or what is translated as fornication.
Right, right.
Okay? That's where that comes in. So adultery, it in the New Testament, the word really actually means confusion of
the bloodline
through sex outside of your married relationship.
Okay. All right.
All right. Not sex outside of marriage.
Yes.
Because there's no such thing as premarital sex in
yes.
Greek
not, no.
or in Hebrew culture.
Not in those days.
Once
yeah.
you copulate for the first time, that's who you're married to.
Yeah. And those marriages were all arranged in those days, you know.
Yes.
Actually,
a Greek man would choose a wife when she was 10 or 12 years old.
Right.
And
right.
he would take this girl home, but he wouldn't have sex with her.
Right. Right.
He wouldn't have sex with her until she was of age, until she was 16.
Right.
But what he did was a Greek man arranged with the father of a woman
yes.
to take this woman when she was 10, 12 years old and put her in the house with his sisters
yeah.
and mother
right.
so that this woman could learn to do things the way his family did them.
Right. And they still do things that way in India and in other cultures as well. You know,
yes.
Yeah.
And they were considered married or betrothed. As
betrothed until she came of age.
Right.
right.
But there was generally, I mean, I can't vouch for every specific instance.
Yes,
but
sure.
generally sex was not acceptable until the girl was 16.
Yes. Okay. Surely. Okay, so let me just finish the chapter 38 of Genesis here, verse 30. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Okay, so Phares is definitely the older son because his whole body came out first, whereas Zerah only had his hand and wrist and certainly part of his arm, upon which the midwife put the scarlet thread, thereby creating the tradition of Zerah of the scarlet thread. But Phares came out first, making him the older son, and is not the case then that Phares is in the bloodline of Mary?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Phares is the direct descendant of Mary and of Joseph, too, I believe.
Yeah, there's a relationship there. I think they had both Mary and Joseph had ancestors in common.
Yes.
Yes. So there's proof beyond a doubt that Jesus Christ had to be pure white, had to be a pure Israelite, or else he could not have been our kinsman redeemer.
Absolutely. You know, to prove that Christ was white is so easy to do from the historians
yes.
of the period. It's not easy to do from the Bible.
Right.
You can't, it can be done from the Bible as long as you take the Bible at face value that all these people stayed
right.
racially pure.
Yes.
And we could go back to the Song of Solomon and prove that it's beyond
yeah.
all doubt that Solomon was a white man.
Yeah, and David was fair and ruddy, meaning white, and he had his blood showed through his cheek.
Absolutely, that's yeah. in 2 Samuel that David is fair and ruddy.
Yes, yeah.
The word ruddy to describe David is Adam.
Right.
In that book, but Josephus says that the Judeans. You couldn't tell them apart from the Greeks if they weren't circumcised.
Right, right. Yeah, so because the Greeks were exiled Israelites of the northern 10 tribes.
Yes.
Yeah, and there are Judahites as well.
All the Greeks of the period literature describe themselves as fair, blonde, redheaded, white-skinned, ivory-skinned, blue-eyed, gray-eyed, green-eyed, whatever. I mean, they're definitely a Caucasian people.
Right, right.
And as white as anybody in Northern Europe today.
Right, right. And then, because we only got about 10 minutes left, because it has to be the case, since the 10 northern tribes who are, you know, we refer to as the dispersed Israelites, the dispersed house of Israel. And when Jesus Christ said, "I come not but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel," that word "lost" is not translated, is not to be translated as, you know, morally lost or spiritually lost or something misplaced. It means, from the Greek apolumi, it means to put away in punishment. And that was only true of who?
That could only be true of the Old Testament Israelites.
That's right.
And I wouldn't limit that to the 10 tribes. That's actually the 10 tribes plus most of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi.
Right, right.
And because representatives of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi were left behind in the city of Jerusalem, they always referred to themselves as the two tribes.
Yes.
And the put-off people as the 10 tribes.
Yes.
But
yes,
that's when you actually read 2 Kings 16, 2 Kings 17, 2 Chronicles in the 30s, where it talks about the Assyrian deportations of Israel, just as much Judah was taken.
Yes.
As could have been possibly left behind.
Right. Yeah. Or, well, possibly even more so. Yeah.
Yeah. The Assyrians took everybody except the inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem.
Right.
And the Bible talks about, in both Israel and Judah, the Bible talks about those who escaped the hands of the Assyrians. Well, some people fled and came back to the land later.
Right.
And they were later called Samaritans, a lot of those people.
Right.
And Yeah, there was just as much Judah with the 10 northern tribes as not.
Right, and those would be the Jutes, the Utes that settled in what is today, well, today I think it's called, not Denmark, I forget the country that it is today, but the Jutes settled in that peninsula, the Jutland Peninsula, and they're probably the Judahites that you're talking about.
Yes, actually the Jutland, it is actually the peninsula, the main body, the mainland portion of Denmark.
Oh, okay. All right.
Is Jutland.
Yeah, okay.
And
all
then
right.
It actually goes further south a little into the heartland of Germany.
Right, exactly.
Those people settled in, a lot of those people, not all of them, a good deal of those people, however, crossed the channel with the Angles and the Saxons and settled in what we know today as Kent.
Yes.
And the area north
Frisia,
of
yes. Yes, they says Frisian, right. Frisia. And the Frisians also have a tradition of being descended from the 12 tribes, which, you know, it gets confusing as to which tribe any particular nationality is descended from. But
for others, also clearly referred to a group of Scythians as the royal Scythians.
Right, okay.
The royal tribe of the Scythians.
Okay, which would be Judah.
And absolutely, that makes sense.
Yes.
And they were mentioned by many other historians,
yes,
the royal Scythians.
Yes. And I know one author equates the Egli and the Angli with the Angles. Okay. So those people. And those would be of the house of Joseph, which would have been of the northern tribes. Okay. So somewhere along the line, the house of Judah and the house of Israel got mixed together in the dispersion. Okay. But those members of the house of Judah ceased practicing circumcision. And isn't this the dispute that Paul and Peter had, that what Paul was trying to explain to Peter was that these people that you don't want to recognize are in fact your brethren of the dispersion. That's what Peter didn't understand. Isn't that correct?
Right. Peter didn't understand that, and most men at the time wouldn't have understood that.
Okay. There's a lot of people today who don't understand it still.
it seems that Josephus, the historian, he sort of hinted at understanding it, but not really. He knew that the Tyrians were Israelites.
Right.
He calls Tyre, quote unquote, one of our cities.
Right. Right.
Okay, and he could have never done that if the Tyrians were Canaanites.
Right. Right.
And that's part of my discourse on my website concerning the Phoenicians.
Yes. Yes. So
the,
that okay, go ahead.
Josephus makes a stab at the Greeks that he kind of says that they think they came from themselves.
Right.
You know? And
which is where the Caucasians came from, right? All the history books say the Caucasians just mysteriously appeared from the Caucasian mountains. No one knows where they came from.
Yeah, right. That all of the 19th century history books definitely infer that.
Yeah.
The older history book. I mean, today they all know we came from Africa and we used to be black.
Right. Exactly.
Which is absolutely crazy.
Well, it's evolution, right?
Yeah.
It was fast-track evolution. So, isn't it true then? Because this is the point I want to bring home before we end today's episode. Didn't Paul understand all this? Wasn't Paul the one who understood? Because he was brought up in Tarsus, realizing that these dispersed Israelites were in fact not Gentiles, as we are falsely taught, because that word Gentile is an abomination. It is a bastardization of ethnos and genos.
Paul stated very plainly that all of these people he was going to in the European nations, and it's in all his epistles, were the increase that God promised to Abraham.
Right.
We just covered that in Hebrews chapter 8.
Right.
He was defending, I mean, it's not explicit, but it's obvious that he was defending his mission to the nations through the Hebrews.
That's right.
And he quoted Genesis, where it said that Abraham would be multiplied.
Yes, yeah. So Paul understood the dispersion much better because he was part of the dispersion. He was a Benjamite of the dispersion.
Well, he was of the post-return dispersion. And that has to be, a lot of people don't realize that there was a dispersion after the dispersion.
Yes, okay.
After the return to Jerusalem and those 40,000 people
from Babylon. Yes.
Yeah, from Babylon, after they began to multiply, they began to branch out into the various cities from the time of the empire, from the time of Alexander the Great.
Right. They increased in multitude greatly, Palestine, but the whole area. Yeah.
Right. They didn't just stay in Palestine or in Jerusalem and Galilee.
Yeah.
A lot of people, most people, and it's their pastor's fault.
Yes.
Their perception of history in the Bible is extremely simple-minded.
Yes, if even existent. It doesn't even exist.
Incredible.
Yeah.
There were Judean, I can't say Jewish, we can't say Jewish. I mean, some of the people were Edomites and some of them were Israelites, and that's clear in Paul's travels.
Right.
There were Judean synagogues throughout the empire.
Yes.
And
yes.
There were Judean synagogues in the Roman-held parts of Germany and Britain in the 1st century A.D., 2nd century A.D.
Yeah, they got around a lot more than people are aware of. Yeah.
Right, and they established these synagogues in every major city as a place where traveling Judeans, whether Edomite or Israelite, there's no distinction here, could go. When they were traveling to a foreign city, they couldn't stay in a hotel,
right?
In a tavern or in Rome, because
there weren't any. Yeah,
everything was unclean to them.
Yeah,
and this is back even before Christ and before the abolition of the law.
Yeah,
everything was unclean to them, and they had to keep the law at this time.
Right,
and they couldn't eat pork, and they couldn't eat out of utensils in which pork was prepared.
Right,
they couldn't stay in a non-Judean inn or tavern.
Right, yeah, and we're talking about the circumcision, those people who emanate from Jerusalem with those traditions.
Right, and many of them may have been legitimate Judahites.
Right. Well, probably, certainly most of them were, because the Pharisees as a sect, which cannot be equated with the Levites, would really not come along until around 150 B.C.
Right.
So those synagogues in Alexandria, in Tarsus, in Germany, etc., would have been founded by pure-blooded Judahites.
They would have, definitely, at that time.
Yes, yes. Now, these Judahites were mixed in with non-circumcision-performing Israelites of the dispersion, including some Judahites and Benjamites and Levites who had left earlier, okay? And they considered these brethren, they did not recognize them as brethren, and they considered them to be unclean. Isn't that the situation?
Well, absolutely. There were, in all of the foreign synagogues, there were local people that attended these synagogues.
Okay.
But the Judeans in Jerusalem definitely considered them to be unclean.
Right.
Because they were not circumcised.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
When Paul goes into Beroia, Thessalonica, Corinth, and into the synagogues, there are people of the uncircumcision attending all these synagogues.
Right. Right,
and usually they're the ones that are persuaded first.
Yes.
By Paul.
right. Yeah, because let me just go into this aspect of it because it is so important. Because Paul is trying to explain to the house of Judah, that is the circumcision, is that all Israel was forgiven at the cross, not just those Israelites who were circumcised. But all Israelites, circumcised or not. Isn't that what Paul was trying to explain to them?
That was the contention, yes.
Yes.
And that's why Paul wrote Hebrews.
Yes. Okay. All right, very good. Well, we're going to continue tomorrow night with the book of Hebrews. I believe we stopped off at chapter 8, so we'll continue with chapters 9 and 10 tomorrow, and Pastor Ken Gregg will be joining us. And for next week, I've been promising people, and we discussed this, that we would start doing a discussion of two seed line, okay?
Yes, so I'm looking forward to that.
We're going, where do you want to start, Genesis 1, 2, or 3?
We'll have to start with all of them at the same time, basically.
All right. Okay.
They're all dependent on each other. We'll just go with the flow with that. Probably not even going to make a whole lot of notes.
Okay, but definitely we have to discuss the beast with a hand issue. And, the fact that Adam and Eve were not the first human beings on the planet. There were other people, probably even in the garden, certainly on the planet, before Adam and Eve were formed. Okay? And so this, Adam and Eve did not produce multiracial offspring, folks. They produced only Adamite, and Adam means to show blood in the face, white offspring. Okay? And so that's, if you don't understand that, then the Bible makes absolutely no sense. Okay.
Well, the first law of the Bible is kind after kind.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's repeated 10 or 12 times in the first two chapters of Genesis.
All right, okay, so you and I are going to have to compare notes. We definitely have to talk about Genesis 1, and then obviously Genesis 2, where Adam and Eve are formed, the breath of life is breathed into them. And then we can talk about the actual seed lines, okay? All right, so that should be it looks like it's going to be a series, folks, not just one show. and then obviously we have to go into Genesis chapter 4, with the culmination being Genesis 4:1. And I have my own translation of Genesis 4:1, which differs remarkably from the King James Version, okay? And then we can trace the genealogy of the Canaanites, the descendants of Cain, and compare that with the descendants of Adam and Seth and Enoch, etc. Okay? So that should be tremendous fun. And, one of the things we want to accomplish there is to show that this position, the two seed line position, is based on solid scholarship, folks. It's not a rabbit we pulled out of a hat. and we want to challenge some of the anti-seed line positions. So we're going to have fun with this, folks. We're going to have a lot of fun with this. Okay. All right, Bill Fink, tremendous job this evening. Praise Yahweh. Thank you for being my guest, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow night.
It's my pleasure. Good night.
Mine as well. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. I think we settled the issue that Phares and Zerah were not mongrels. and the bastard, and they were bastards by the definition of the mainline churches, and yet they were counted, their generation was counted in the genealogy of Jesus Christ without any problem. That's because they were not mongrels, folks, even though they were born out of wedlock. Praise Yahweh. Good night.